So I'm going to start with provision of safe environment or safe living place. Now, the environment we find ourselves in, it could be the hospital environment, it could be home environment, it could be nursing home, it could be anywhere we find ourselves. It could be critical or like a, it could be urgent care environment. We need to always provide safe environment for our patients. Now, safe environment ranges from fire safety to workplace safety and other things. All those ones are included into safe environment. With fire safety, there are a few things I know we all understand when it comes to fire safety. We have vast idea on fire safety, but I'm going to take my little time to just brush over fire safety, talk about a few things on the fire safety, then we can move ahead. You want to make sure when there's a fire in an environment, you want to try by all means to help to create alarm and other things to provide safety for yourself, for the patients you are taking care of in the environment. One of those things we do in fire safety is to keep open the spaces in our surroundings or clutter free. We want to have a clutter free environment. There should be no clutter in the environment. We want to be sure that this is not happening in the environment, which can cause also hazard. We want to make sure we clearly mark the fire exits. That's why if you enter any public building, any big building, you're going to see exit sign everywhere. Because when there's a fire, we want to be able to find our best route out. Some people might be visiting the institution. They might not be working in the institution. They might not know the building as possible as a full-time staff working in the building. So it is incumbent upon us to mark the areas as exit and other places that can be easily used in terms of emergency. We want to make sure we know the locations of all the fire alarms in the building. We want to make sure we know the telephone numbers to report in emergency to. We want to know the fire drills, the fire evacuation plan for staff members. That's why it is incumbent upon every institution that has more than one or two people living and working in that institution to have a fire drill plan, to have a regular fire drill that they can use to know where we can gather, to know what can be done when there's a fire in the building, to know who do we call, how do we make the alarm to sound, how do we test all those things, all those things before we can begin working in those environment. We want to make sure we let our patients, our clients, to know that when there's a fire in the building, no matter how tall the building can be, we do not want to use the elevator. We want to make sure also we turn off all O2 and other appliances within the range of the fire. We want to make sure we ambulate the patients who can walk by themselves first. When there's a fire, our first concern becomes patients who can walk, who can move by themselves. That's the first concern. Next concern is those who are in wheelchair, who can move the wheelchair. And our last concern becomes individuals who cannot move, who are bedridden. That becomes our last concern. So this concern should be met every time we have patients, we have fire incident in our environment. We want to also make sure that in the event of when there's a fire occurring, we want to make sure we access the fire and use RACE, RACE and PASS. Those acronyms are very important to use. And we have to also know the kind of fire that is occurring. If we can extinguish the fire, we gotta know what type of extinguisher can we use to cut off a fire. We gotta know all those things. Those things, I'm not gonna go deep into them because we have much idea on those things and other things. Now, one of the safety issues that I want to talk about is radiation. Radiation safety is important in the hospital, and it comes in the end class a lot, radiation. There are two kinds of radiation. We have the internal and external radiation under one aspect, and we have other, the one that fall under using those machines, the X-ray machine, other things. That's another form of radiation. Now, in radiation safety, we have to understand the protocol and the guidelines of the healthcare agency. These radioactive material, they are labeled in a way that we can read them and understand what to be done if we find ourselves in those departments. We want to reduce exposure to radiation as much as possible, because this radioactive element, this radiation light, or this radiation can cause us serious health problems. Like in the case of a cell deformity, they can cause the cells to become deformed, and those cells can become cancerous cells, and they can cause us, they can also expose us to cancer condition. We want to make sure to limit the time spent to the source of radiation. We want to make sure to make the distance between the source of the radiation to us very far as possible. We all want to use a shield that can prevent us from having the effect of this radiation to our body cells. Those are things we want to make sure. Now, when there is radiation, that's what the ones who have in the implant, that is internal radiation. So for a patient who has an implant in their body to produce radiation, that patient or that individual needs to be in a private room. That's the first thing I want to know. We cannot have someone who undergoing internal radiation with other patients, because even their sweat, their body fluid can also transmit that radioactive element into other individuals. So they need to be in private rooms. We never want to touch any implants that fall off the patient's body. So if they had a piece of metal in their body that is radiating, if it drops on the floor, we cannot touch it with our bare hands. It will also transmit the same radioactive element into us, which might cause us to have serious health problems. We want to keep all linens in the patient's room until the implant is removed. There is a procedure for managing the linens, the beddings, the clothing for the patient, and other equipment they are using in their room. We cannot touch them. We cannot join them, put them in among other linens to wash them. They must be treated separately and apart from other materials in the hospital. They must be treated separately. They cannot be together in the same place. These are guidelines I want to understand about this radiation. We want to make sure. Now, if we are to dispose an infectious waste from individuals who having this problem, we want to handle all infectious material as hazard that are capable of transmitting the same infection or the same dangers that we are trying to treat. Every waste product from a radioactive an individual who is undergoing internal radiation, even the urine, the sweat, the feces, all contains radioactive elements. So they must be handled, they must be treated with caution, that those body waste products have in them radioactive element that is capable of transmitting those radioactive element into somebody else that might be dangerous for their health. We want to make sure with the support of all shops right after use in closed puncture resistant disposal containers that are leak proof and labeled or color coded. Needles and shaps should not be recapped, bent, or for any reason. And anytime nowadays, all the needles that you have in the hospitals, they have their own cap that you, when you prick the patient, once you pass the last unit of medication within the syringe, it caps by itself. Sometimes when you pull it out, you just press the button, and it closes. It's going to get closed by itself. So all these things are designed in a way to reduce the transmission of infection between patient to patient or between patient to healthcare providers. some other patients who need ambulation, who cannot move around, they might use gait belt, and we must understand how these things can work. So those are just common things. Another one is poison. Poison control. Now, when it comes to poison, it is a big thing because not all poisons have antidotes. Some poison that we might ingest or our kids might ingest do not have antidote, do not have treatment or that can save the patient. Some will look at the patient will die because we do not have the antidote for the patient. There are some that have antidotes. Some we can use other mechanism to control the poison if they are introduced into the patient's system. So all those things, gotta be careful. Now with poison ingestion, when a patient ingests poison, poison has the ability to destroy life when we ingest it, or when we inhale it, or when our body absorbs the poison through other means. Sometimes poison could be on the skin, and the spores on the skin could get the poison into our system. Sometimes it could be through our mouth. Sometimes we inhale poison. So there are different means through which we can inhale or we can take in poison. Now, there are specific antidotes or treatment for some of the poison that we're going to ingest, but not everything. Poison can impair a lot of systems in our body. When we ingest poison, it impairs our respiratory system. That's one. It impairs our circulatory system. That's two. It impairs our nervous system. It impairs our GI system. It impairs our renal system. It impairs our liver or our hepatic system. All these impairments can be done from ingestion of poison. Now, not all poison might impair all at the same time. There are some other poison that can impair just one or two different systems. Some going to impair all the systems I talk about. So it depends on the kind of poison that is ingested or inhaled or that finds its way into our body. That's how the impairment can occur. The toddlers, the preschoolers, and the young age children must be protected from poison because they are the ones that most often they come in contact with poison. When there's a poison injection, we want to make sure we follow the procedure. Individuals who have eyes problems are also at risk, plus the children I talk about. Because if you have an eye problem, you cannot see what is around you, you might ingest it accidentally. Now, a poison control center phone number is always by the house phone. Where we're going to have 911 for emergency, we need to always have the poison control phone number by that same telephone at the same place we're going to write 911 for emergency. Now, in case of a suspected poisoning or poison injection, the number should be called immediately. When we figure out that there is a poison injection, we have to call the poison control center right away. Now, in the English, they'll give a case scenario between what to choose between poison injection and also the procedure. Now, there are two things going to happen. If you walk on the scene and saw a patient ingesting the poison or having the poison in his or her mouth, the first thing is to remove that poison from the mouth or to empty the mouth of the poison. That's the first thing. The next thing is to call the poison control center. That's the second thing. Now, in a case wherein you did not meet it in their hands, they have already ingested it. Now, then it becomes, what can I act or should I call the poison control center? With that situation, the first thing you do is to place the call. So you do not try to intervene before placing a call. You must make the call first before you can intervene. So calling the poison control center number comes ahead of intervention with poison injection. The reason is you might not know exactly what what the magnitude of the thing that might be called, what could be the procedure. You might not know what is being ingested, how the poison is. By you trying to provide intervention, it might be too late when you make the call. So you gotta make the call first before intervention. That's one thing I want us to know. We want to make sure if it's in the eyes or any body part, remove it from the eyes immediately. Identify the type and amount of substance ingested. So in the hospital, when a patient ingests a poison or an ulcer, they will ask you, what poison did he ingest? Was it a Listerine? Was it a bleach? How much? What's the volume of the amount of ml that he ingested? Is it 2 ml, 3 ml, or is it 1 ounce? Is it 0.5 ounces? Now, they want to ask this person to know what how many quantity the person took in, because the amount of quantity they took in for poison, it depends on the prognosis also sometimes. If the victim vomits or is vomiting is induced, meaning if the victim vomits the poison or if there is vomiting induced, save the vomitus of the patient because they will have to see and know what is it, how is it looking like. So you have to save the vomitus, you have to save it and make sure and deliver it to the poison control center. If you are told to take the person who ingested the poison to an emergency room, do not drive the patient yourself. You have to call 911, no matter under what circumstances. Whether it is poison or any emergency condition, you want to call 911 because the ambulance has a way to communicate, has a way to create avenue if there's no roads instead of your personal car. So you have to always call the ambulance to transport the patient to the nearest ER to get treatment. You never want to induce vomiting. If the patient ingested any of these household chemicals, one, lye, L-Y-E, L-Y-E. If the patient ingested lye, you cannot induce vomiting. That's one. Now, you cannot induce vomiting if the patient ingested household cleaner that is ingested by the patient, you cannot induce vomiting with the household cleaner. If the ingested grease, G-R-E-A-S-E, any grease of any type, you cannot induce vomiting. You cannot also induce vomiting if the patient ingested any petroleum product, like Vaseline, petroleum product. You cannot induce vomiting, or like gas, like kerosene, like fuel. If the any of these things they ingested, you do not want to induce vomiting. These are the most common ones that they're gonna ingest, and you cannot induce vomiting with these things. If you do, it might cause a serious problem. Never induce vomiting in an unconscious patient. These are things that you gotta look at. Any question on these ones? Like you have standard precautions. It's not precautions. The nurses must practice standard precaution with all patients in any setting, regardless of the patient diagnosis or presumed infectiousness. So when you work in a hospital, everyone that you're gonna see under your care as patient, you must engage in helping them or doing anything for them through standard precaution. That's one thing you must engage with them, through standard precautions. For these patients, standard precautions include hand washing and use of gloves, masks, eye protection, and gowns when appropriate. Now, I did not say you should use all at the same time. Standard precautions, if you have to touch somebody's body, the person having a body fluid coming out, you use gloves. If they are having something that will flash in your eyes, you use goggles or masks. If they have anything that's gonna smell like poop and other things, you use Max. If they have something that's gonna splat on your clothes, you wear gown. All those things is what we call cleanup precaution. It could be gown, it could be goggle, it could be mask, it could be glove. They are all under cleanup precaution. Just so you know that. If you come in contact with them, any body fluid, want to wash your hand with soap and water. If it's just touching the patient or touching other body part with our body fluid or being him being sore, you can use disinfectant. Then you have transmission-based precautions. These ones include airborne, droplet precautions, or contact precautions. These are all transmission-based precautions. In the transmission-based precautions, with airborne, you have disease conditions like measles. Let's look at airborne. Airborne precaution, you have measles. You have measles for airborne precautions. You have chickenpox. You have chickenpox. These markers are. You have chickenpox. You have conditions like the varicella zoster. You have tuberculosis. These are all airborne infection. So you have measles, chickenpox, tuberculosis, disseminated varicella zoster. These are all airborne precaution conditions. Then you have the barrier precautions. For barrier precautions conditions, a single room can be used. Patient can use a single room, or they can be in a under negative pressure room. The door remains closed except upon entering and exiting. So for negative pressure room, the door should always remain closed because our goal is to prevent what is in there from coming out in negative pressure room. What is the person for barrier precaution like COVID-19? If someone is on the hospital unit who has COVID-19, we put it in the negative pressure because their air they are breathing out, we do not want it to get mixed into the atmosphere. So that means COVID-19 tuberculosis patients who have these airborne conditions, they should be in the negative pressure room. That simply means what they are breathing out of their body cannot, or we do not want to mix it up in the atmospheric air. That's why we are placing it in the negative pressure room. Now, other individuals who have immune compromise, they have low immunity, they have less CD4 counts. For those individuals, they are placed in the positive pressure room. That means we do not want what other people breathing outside in the atmosphere to come in their room. So in negative pressure room, what is in the room cannot go out. In positive pressure room, what is outside cannot come in the room. Simple as that. So these things occur in our healthcare setting. In negative pressure room, there is a little amount of air exchange that we must know for the anchors. In this negative pressure room, we want to have a minimum of 6 to 12 air exchanges per hour. In every hour, we want to have 6 to 12. 12 the maximum amount of air that's going to be exchanged between the room and the atmosphere. We want to make sure we follow the protocol. We can also have ultraviolet germicide irradiation or high efficacy particulate air filter is used in the room. That is for individuals. For the room, we use these things to filter the air to help to destroy anything that comes from outside that come into the room, or what is coming from the room about to go outside. When the patient is breathing out, we have something in the room that can destroy those organisms that come from the patient's body. That's why we call it negative pressure room. Then we have masks should be placed on the patient when he is to be transferred to other part of the hospital. They wear masks. Clients leave the room only if it is necessary. Then we have the droplet precautions. On droplet precautions, we have some other conditions. On the droplets, you have diphtheria. It's on a droplet. You have epiglottitis, you have influenza, you have meningitis, you have mumps, you have the parvovirus, you have pneumonia, all these conditions, including pertussis, rubella, scarlet fever, sepsis, streptococcus pharyngitis, all these conditions are under droplet precautions, just so you know that. Then we have contact precautions and other conditions that we talk about, like the C. difficile infections. We talk about like the scabiasis, like other skin infections, conjunctivitis. They are all under these infections. You want to make sure you provide for them the best mechanism to prevent other patients from contracting these conditions. You can go ahead and look at them more. You cannot learn these things just by looking at them. You have to make sure you look at them over and over, and you put them in the writing that you can look at it and know which one is which. Think about it, how patient with this condition, what is they're going to show. Based upon these symptoms, we can say, okay, these are airborne, droplet, or direct contact precautions, depending on how they're going to have these conditions. Any questions?